You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.
Radiant Creators is jazzed to be interviewing Thomas Sheridan today. He's an author, artist, and filmmaker from Dublin, Ireland, who came to international recognition in 2011 with the book Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. In years since, he's written several more books and has made films on topics such as social engineering and political and corporate pathology. In this interview, it was fun. It was off the rails. I didn't know where it was going to go. I just held on and really had a great time. We talked about a recent video Thomas made called Get Off the Chessboard, really about freeing yourself to be yourself and not worrying about saving the world, just work on your own path. Also, we covered psychic attacks are very real and very dangerous. That's an article on his website, and definitely check that out. If you've ever felt kind of crappy around a crappy person, well, this dives into exactly why and also what you can do about it. And we even touched on the magic techniques that David Bowie used and where he got those from, William Burroughs. And Thomas goes into how to use some of those in your own life right now to have fun and have a little peek into the future and make the future softer and more pliable. He has a new book out called Sorcery, The Invocation of Strangeness. Definitely go and check that out. So take care, have a good time listening. Yeah, let's just start with a little bit of an easy icebreaker. And that is Joe Rogan of the Joe Rogan Podcast. He mentioned something called the spell of the glass. And I like to call it also like the glass spell. And it's everybody's phone. When I see humanity right now as I'm living, especially driving around, more and more it seems that people can't even drive to the store to get a frozen pizza without being on their phone. It's almost like get in the car, get on your phone, and then drive. And of course, when people are walking, they're falling over things, they're getting run over by cars. So it seems like a question I'd ask, because this kind of, I think, fits your research and your background, are people literally being hypnotized right out of their experience with physical life by their phones?
There's something about the dark, shiny surface that human consciousness falls into it, literally falls into it by staring into it. In ancient times, this was discovered. Someone was looking in probably a muddy pool on a sunny day and saw their own reflection. It might even be the root of the Narcissus legend of ancient Greece. And they fell into it. And you probably had a situation where something like a priest class or a shamans came along to be the only arbiters of the oracle, the vision. Because if everyone was doing it, the tribal structure would have fallen apart. And there is something about the polished black mirror that if you stare into it long enough, you eventually don't see yourself staring back, you see something else. Now, this is a well-known phenomenon. It's actually openly encouraged by magical groups such as the Golden Dawn. You hold up a black mirror, it's usually polished obsidian or any black reflective surface. I know people have painted boards black and put a high level of varnish on them. I know one guy even did it into a black guitar, believe it or not, that was highly lacquered. And you put a light on either side, and staring into the black in the center, you'll see yourself looking back for a while, but often you'll change. You'll have the face of a lion. It's a very common one. You'll see yourself staring back as you were a lion. This is a very, very interesting experience. Often you'll see yourself as a demon, or a demon looking at you that's kind of merged. When I say a demon, I mean a demonic-like face, a twisted, distorted, like an orc from Lord of the Rings. And usually people who tried this experiment, they jump back in terror. And they never do it again, because if you're not aware that this is a normal effect with these, well, when I say normal, I mean it happens to anyone who does it. They get frightened and they think they've seen a demon or they think they're being possessed. If you're not getting that back at you, you will fall in love with your own reflection. in the, again, like the Narcissus mythology of Greek, of the Greek pantheon. Now, if you look at a modern mobile device, a smartphone, it is exactly like a black obsidian mirror that you have on ritual magic, such as the Golden Dawn practice. It's got a light on either side, and you hold it sideways when you're watching a movie, or it doesn't matter, you hold it vertically, and you stare into this mirror. Now, this we'll just call it the digital djinn, and I'm using metaphor here. The digital djinn refuses you no demand. If you want porn, you get porn. If you want sport, you get sport. If you want to see hobby stuff, you get hobby stuff. And what the digital djinn is doing is it's creating a confirmation bias feedback loop with your consciousness. So everything you love is on that phone, in that black mirror. And everything you dislike, you don't pay attention to. So there's no referral system. You're totally involved in a love affair with your own cognition and consciousness through this engagement with the mobile device, because you're going to only spend time looking at what you love. And this is human nature. And you'll only follow political systems or political beliefs that you align to, religious beliefs, spiritual beliefs, atheistic beliefs, whatever. You will literally fall in love with yourself in terms of you're falling in love with your own personality, because you're getting a feedback constantly of all the things you love. And this is why people are falling through that gate and into another reality, quite literally. There's no critic there for them. There's no one to say you're wrong, you must stop this. There's no one, and if they do, they rebel violently against it, because they're being basically told that they can't love themselves anymore. Are we falling as a society deeply into it? This could be a trend. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, people played Atari video games, and you were told that they'd never grow up to be normal people. They're sitting there all day playing Space Invaders or, you know, Galaxy or, you know, Moon Landing, one of these games, Asteroids. And those people grew up perfectly fine. So we're at an experimental stage, but I don't think it's ever been done at this level to this enormous amount of numbers. My attitude is let's wait and see.
It wasn't until recently that you could actually walk around with your device and look at it, where at least like with Atari or any video games, you tend to have to be at home. At least you're when you're out in the world, you're out in the world experiencing it more directly. Well, you mentioned that people can kind of live in a bubble, kind of have a certain confirmation bias. They only see what they want to see, and they don't see what they don't want to see. And I wonder if that could be somehow linked to the polarization we have in society right now. At least I'll say just for America, since that's where I live and that's my experience, it's that I've never lived in a time that was more, we have, like in World War One, there used to be no man's land between the trenches, and now we don't even have a no man's land between the trenches. There's just, people right in each other's face, kind of, separate warring factions. I wonder if it's, I don't know, if it's in any way related to that. I mean, do people seem to be getting crazier and more polarized to you at this time?
Well, I know the United States quite well. I've lived there for a long time. I've been back and forth a lot. I was only there just before Christmas. And so I know Americans and America quite well. And yeah, I've never seen anything like it. I'm amazed by it. The polarization, I think in some ways, I wonder if America is going through a kind of a reformation, like the Protestant Reformation in Europe, where you had Catholics and Protestants tearing each other apart, 300-400 years ago. And it's almost like that on a technological level, on a media and a cultural level. The political system in America is truly bizarre at the moment. You have the left wing, who are extremely intolerant and want to shut down everything. And the right wing, amazingly enough, people I would have most of my life had nothing to do with, seem to be the ones who are more tolerant. It's been a complete reversal of, it's flipped completely. People are often, and because it is, but back to this, the Black Mirror again, because people are are fed this idea within their phones and their mobile devices that you're right, everything you believe is right, everything, you cannot be challenged, your view of reality is the best one for everyone, that when they confront the sizable proportion of society, let's just say in the case of America, people who voted for Trump versus people who voted for Hillary Clinton, they cannot grasp that the other side exists. They just cannot grasp. They cannot get it into their head. And to them, this represents a broken aspect of reality. That reality is somehow broken, and they're raging against it. They're raging against this conformity that they longed for, this kind of liberal progressive world that's dead, basically. And ironically, it was the liberals behaving like the Bolsheviks or like the National Socialists that ultimately destroyed it. They became intolerant of other people's opinions. America's in a very dangerous place, I think, at the moment in some ways, because I watched something the other night. It was Jordan Peterson on Bill Maher. And I like Jordan Peterson for the most part. I think he makes a lot of sense, and I don't see anything radical about the guy at all. And the panel was made up of people who were just smug, the worst kind of sickeningly smug liberals you could imagine. Now, I come from a background where my opinions would have been probably liberal for most of my life until very recently. And I'm not conservative, by the way. I'm not conservative. I'm definitely kind of like a centralized anarchist, if such a thing. And the smugness was nauseating. It was vomit inducing. They thought all they wanted to do was to get a cheap applause from the audience, or a cheap laugh, was to mention the sheer mention of Trump's name. Now this is there's people at home in the United States who did vote for Trump, who were not idiots, who were not morons, who are not rednecks, who are not racists, who are perfectly decent, intelligent people, and you're radicalizing them because they're making them angry. This panel of hosts, they're making them angry. And when you have that much of a charge bubbling up, it will blow, and it generally won't be very pretty.
I like the term that you used, centralized anarchist. Yeah, I definitely kind of consider myself a bit of a apolitical anarchist myself, you know, centering around just the sovereignty of the individual. Yeah, here in America, it seems like, I don't know which way it's going to go either. I think that we're pushing ourselves right now back into our, like, original values, the original, like, what the deplorables, as you might say, you know, had in mind. I have a great, well, I live here in Arizona, and of course, it's quite the liberty-loving state, and I have this one t-shirt, it just says deplorables on it, and has the Founding Fathers on it, and I get lots of, you know, right on, man, when I wear that. So I hope that we're just pushing ourselves back into our foundations of how what the country was founded upon. Or at least the idea. I mean, I know there's many ways people can look at that. Go ahead.
Yeah, the way I see it is very similar to what happened in Brexit in England. The working class were given a chance to give the finger to the social establishment and the political and cultural establishment, and they did it. They were given their opportunity to actually have a voice. And when I think of what the alternative could have been, a psychopathic lunatic like Hillary Clinton, think it was good that Trump won, not because I support Republican values or anything like that. It's just that you needed that archetype in American society at this moment to disturb, just like the archetype of Brexit in England, to disturb the political establishment, very healthy, I might add, to shake things up a bit, and also to get people thinking about their destiny as individuals within a society. So yeah, well, you know, observe it and see where it takes us. But I agree with you. The thing about getting back to the traditional values of the United States, I don't know how that would work. I mean, I don't have these fantasies of Ireland returning back to the ancient Breton laws and things like that. And I don't know how they would work in the modern age. But I think in terms of what you said about the ethos of the idea of the ethos of the Founding Fathers, Well, I think that's a pretty noble idea. I don't see any problem with that. It's ironic that came out of Protestant Enlightenment, the Protestant Enlightenment as well. So, yeah, I think it depends where you live in the United States, but I do think basically Trump is really a working class phenomenon. I really do.
The thing about Trump that many I don't think realize, and I think this helps to depolarize the situation a little bit, is Trump could have won running as a Republican or a Democrat because people voted for him. They didn't vote for Republicans, if you know what I'm saying. So it's not the ideal of the party. So Trump, I really believe that Trump could have, if he could have run as a Democrat, and he could have won. So I look at it, people need to look at who is Trump, why did he win, and not think about whether he's on the left or on the right, because he's really sort of neither. He's unique. Yeah. So we'll see what happens in America.
That's beautifully put. I've never heard anyone say that before, but you're bang on. He could have ran for the monster mad raving loony party and still have won. You're right. They voted for a person, and that's what terrifies the political establishment, because they don't have those kind of personalities. All they have are horrible politicians.
Yeah, all they have is, you know, one choice or the other, and it's just a matter, and most of the countries already made up their mind. They don't really even need to debate when it comes down to it. Well, something I wanted to, I saw there's a great article on your site, and it's called Psychic Attacks Are Very Real and Very Dangerous. And that is, you've done amazing work on, you know, what is the sociopath, and that's something everyone should check out. But I wanted to kind of touch on a little bit an article you wrote, of course, Psychic Attacks Are Very Real and Very Dangerous. And I think there's hardly anyone who hasn't, if a person has a bit of self-awareness, I am sure they must have felt attacked by another person psychically, energetically. And I've noticed that, I'm going to read a line or two from your article here. You're saying, this is why I have come to believe that conditions such as chronic fatigue syndrome, which are often dismissed as nonsense or hypochondria by doctors and scientists, may well be caused by a psychic attack. And then you also mentioned when it comes to how do you deal with the psychic attacker, is you say, put simply, you have to run away and hide. And it's something I really feel strongly, is that we are porous. And I think a lot of times people, they get told this notion, or they try to work with this notion, that you can sort of fill yourself with a white light and push them away. And I just feel that we're porous. We really cannot help but be attacked by a psychic attacker or negative energy in general.
Yeah, run away. And that's not cowardice. It's a strategic withdrawal. You've got to, when you're under a psychic attack, and I've been under a psychic attack by actual cults, deliberately doing it, and it was you cannot describe it. Now, you know, it'll kill people. It happens in workplaces. You can have people in your job who will do it to people they work with, a gang of bullies in an office or something like this. It happens all the time, and people think it's just stress. No, they're actually being energetically depleted and stolen. The energy's been stolen by these malevolent creatures. Now, the thing is to run away. People, you know, as I said in the article, it all sounds very gallant, and this wonderful idea of Harry Potter and two magicians in combat. But often you don't know directly the source of the psychic attack. That's a very common thing as well. You just don't know where it's coming from. It could be somebody who you're commuting to work on the bus or train who's taken a hatred of you, and you don't even notice them. They don't even know they exist. And you may be better looking, you may be happier, you may have a prettier girlfriend or boyfriend, and they will go after you in the most, then they will energetically drain you to their hatred. The thing is that you've got to get away. Now, there are, it will, you know, you can't fight them back by psychically attacking them back. It's like, you can't do that. You know, you need positive and negative energy. You can't fight positive energy or you can't deal with positive energy by putting more positive energy to it. You need polarity. So the thing is, you've got to run away. Now, what do I mean by run away? Is you've got to, you know, if you're in a place where you think it's happening, you've got to leave it. If you're in a relationship where it's happening, but do not be drawn into combat. When I say combat, I mean confronting that person straight up, or because it will only get much worse. And also, you know, you don't have any tangible evidence to deal with that. So I've expanded on this in my new book, Sorcery. And there are things you can do, certain objects you can collect, certain ways you can guard your sacred space, your body space, your psychic energy, that will give you enough energy then to actually make rational decisions. Dion Fortune was writing books about this 70 years ago and people were not listening. And it's unfortunate that it's not taken seriously. But you will waste away and die if you don't address the problem. And a lot of it is just protecting your energetic force. That's really it. And then you can kind of hope that the malevolent entity loses interest in you because they're not harvesting you. Or you can deflect it back somehow. After a while, not in the heat of the moment, it takes time. Everything in sorcery and magic takes time. It's just like a baby gestating in the womb. It won't happen like abracadabra or gazam, and it instantly happens. It doesn't happen like that. You're planting a garden of psychic power. So yeah, psychic attacks are something I feel very strongly about. It's something that people need to get their heads around and get their shit together on, because it's probably causing vast amounts of medical problems to people who have these mysterious illnesses. So yes, it's very, very important to look into that idea.
Definitely, and I'm glad you wrote that article. A lot of power in that. And so you're saying that also your new book has more info on that, understanding it and working with it. And definitely will, in the show notes, we will, of course, link to your site and link to that book too. So definitely worth checking out, because I do think that it was over a year ago, I stopped working, you know, daily in the corporate world, and it probably took me, it's been a year and a half now, I forget how long ago it was, but it took me at least a year to recover from that. And I think that that actually had, like what you're mentioning, psychic attack had a lot to do with it. I mean, because when you're in an office where basically sociopaths are the ones, or the psychopath, I always get them mixed up, sociopath and psychopath, when you're in an office where those are the people who rise to the top, those are the people who run things. Yep. I mean, they're just that is a feeding ground for them, because they can just for the love of torturing people is why they go to work every day.
Yeah, you did the right thing and got out of it. Anywhere there's a pyramidal structure, you will find these pathological types rise to the top, and you will have to deal with them in many aspects of life. And There's people who say things like, you can fight them. You must never, ever fight them. They'll do the most appalling things, things you couldn't even imagine against you. They also will capitalize upon the mentally ill. This is one of the reasons that, and not enough has spoken about this, psychopaths often keep control by surrounding themselves with the mentally ill. They will use the mentally ill to attack others, to run smear campaigns. They will use the mentally ill as Renfields, in exactly the same way that Count Dracula used Renfield in the novel. They will be used them in that way. Because a person who's mentally unstable or unhinged is very easy to get into their psyche if you're a pathological individual. And it's a very interesting master and servant relationship. I've seen this many times, that a full-blown psychopath will have literally a handful of psychiatric individuals or people with a history of mental health, and they will exploit them in order to attack others, spread lies, spread smear campaign. They'll keep them like farm animals. And so that's another thing people have to be wary of. It's this idea of you can be a hero on a battlefield, but you can't be a hero on the psychic battlefield unless you really are at the top of your game in terms of defending your psychic space. For the average person, especially an intelligent or a creative person, you've got to run, because you need that energy for yourself. You need that energy for yourself.
I like that. I mean, and it's definitely not cowardly to make a run for it, because I think I call it, there was a word for this and I forget what it is, because it's Italian, but I remember the Italian military has this move that they do, and it's where they retreat facing the enemy. And I kind of look at it like that, because when you get routed back in the day, when you were fighting with, you know, muskets and bayonets, I mean, most of the casualties came from the routing. When people made a run for it, they were easy to stab in the back. And so I find that the Italian strategy of retreat while facing your enemy, and then the next thing you know, your enemy's standing there wondering, where'd they go? So you can always be crafty like that.
Superb. I love that.
And then as far as the psychopath in charge, surrounding themselves, I've always kind of called the the little inner circle that they'll have, their henchmen or their thugs. And it's funny, the henchman and or the thug, as you might call them, they'll think they're special, and that specialness really will drive them to be a worse sociopath than the one that they actually serve. And the funny thing is, in that situation, whether you're a henchman, which I've never been, or somebody who's just in that chain, the moment you see the sociopath for who they are, you recognize them and you see them, and they know that you see them. You have this recognition. Oh, I know what you are. You're demonic. You know, you're gone. Anybody who sees them clearly, they will remove from that organization instantly, almost. So
yeah, that's why in my first book, Puzzling People, I suggested that one of the ways you can maybe deal with them in a work environment or an organizational environment is to leave books on psychopaths on your desk. That can usually be enough to make some of them, not all of them, do a runner.
Oh, I like that. So it can work both ways. To recognize them can cause them to be afraid of you or just leave you alone, or it can cause them to attack. So yeah, it's kind of I guess if you're stuck in that situation, that could be at least a last-ditch strategy. If you're losing, it might work. Or, you know, or a first one. Well,
The first one really should be to try and get away. If you can't get away, you can suddenly need a book on your desk and you just say, what's this about? You know, get something like Snakes in Suits or Without Conscience or, you know, that kind of thing. And I said to people, put a copy of a book on psychopaths in the office or the workplace, face up on the desk and reading it during your lunch break. Don't imply anything. Don't look at them when you're doing it. Just casually do it. And that's often enough to, like, they might leave you alone. You know, that's another thing too. But that would be an early day thing. You know, that would be an early day way of dealing. It's unavoidable of dealing with it.
I really like that. Yeah, because there's a lot of people who are stuck in that situation. And that's great advice because, so along with checking out your article on psychic attack and getting your latest book, it does not hurt to put a book on sociopaths on your desk. That will freak them out. I like that. There's a recent YouTube video that you did, and it's called Getting Off the Chessboard, and I totally dug it. And we'll link to that, of course, in show notes so that people can find it easily. But a couple quotes from that I really wanted to just touch on, because I think they're brilliant, I really like them, is one thing that you said is, to wait for a great awakening among the masses is an elegant form of suicide. And I think that's important. And I wanted to touch on that because there's so many people who, as they are waking up, or, you know, so something happens with an individual, maybe they're born awake, maybe they start to awaken throughout their life. I mean, I know it's kind of difficult to define, but I'm just going to call it, they're waking up, they're becoming spiritually aware. They oftentimes have this desire to save others, they get attached to this notion that they cannot have their own ascension, like they cannot have their own growth without everybody else doing it too. And I think a really harsh realization people have to come to, I think we're so programmed to think we have to save the world, like don't grow yourself, save the world, and or somehow that those two are linked, hard linked. And really, once a person gets into that, they seem to really give their power away, because if we're really honest with ourselves, you don't want to save the world. You just want it to be the way you'd like it to be. And we've already seen plenty of dictators kill millions doing that. It's not a noble thought. So this noble natural desire that happens within the soul to become self-aware all of a sudden gets hijacked by, no, you know, be this dictator. Does that sound valid at all?
Yeah, well, see, where that comes from is evangelical Christianity. This idea that there's one day Jesus is going to come down from the sky and we're all going to be raptured and all this kind of thing. And all we need is enough souls to do it. It even mentions these ideas in Revelations. And that is filtered into the social culture and even the collective unconscious as a whole. That all we need is an event. And you see it in everything. For people, one day a UFO will come and take the chosen. One day the comets will come and pick the chosen. One day away from outer space will come and pick us, the chosen, or this kind of thing. And this is all rooted in evangelical Christianity. The idea is that you don't have, all you have to do is to make people know that you're coming with you. And unfortunately, this alternative and this alternative movement has its roots in Bible Belt Christianity. And that's where this salvation redemptionist idea has entered into it. If you lived in a more sort of a European paganism or an Indo-European paganism culture, you'd have people, instead of trying to save everyone else, you'd have Leif Erikson's who'd be sailing to discover America and this kind of thing. They would be adventurers. Unfortunately, they're not adventurers now. They're waiting for some event to lift all the boats up into heaven. And it's a huge problem, a huge problem. Excuse me. Now, the biggest issue with this is that the people are going to hit a wall eventually when they realize that not only has no one woken up around them, maybe they might have minor success, but they've been alienated from their families because it comes a kind of addiction, this kind of like crusade. That's what, you know, it's a personal crusade, and it only leads to horror. It only leads to personal misery. And I'll tell you why. Every time you put your psychic energy into an external force that you have no control over, whether it be the second coming of a Messiah, the salvation from the space brothers, this kind of thing, or all that kind of idea, great political or social awakening, you have literally taken your psychic energy and thrown it off into space. You've depleted it. It's gone. Boom. Right? And it's not coming back. So a pathological kind of feeding frenzy comes in that you think, if I throw more and more of it out, I try to wake up more and more people, I'll eventually get it back. And what happens is it's like being a heroin addict. The next fix is the one that I'll get off, and it never gets, and you never get off until you have no friends, your family all think you're mentally ill. You might even end up in a psychiatric hospital, a drug addict, an alcoholic, or suicidal as your wife and kids walk out the door because they don't care that 9/11 had some fishy aspects to it. Why should they? Why should they care? Think about it. Why should they care? And this is narcissism. Oh, this is my belief now. I'm right. I have all the answers in the world. And now I'm going to make sure that you know them. Who the hell are you to actually think to do that? Is any wonder that people ignore people who do that kind of thing? And it's not a good path to go down. And I don't like a lot of these truth gurus and other people who say we're going to be a big awakening soon. Everyone's going to wake up. It's giving a false, misleading impression of an event that's never going to come. And it's what's terrible about it more than anything else is it's robbing the individual of their personal potential and creativity in life.
Definitely. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, our own growth is so delicious. It's so good. I hate to see people lose their passion, start pouring it into the darkness. And because you don't get that energy back, like you're saying, and you don't get wasted years and lifetimes back, you really blew it. And so, especially when you have the direct experience of, I don't know, becoming more self-aware, I would hope that everyone does that rather than kind of fall for just sending their energy into the void, basically. Here in this country, I guess it's probably universal. I mean, around the world, I guess. But like here in this country, we have the QAnon phenomenon, the supposed, I guess you'd say, like deep state insider who's telling us what's going on and such. And a lot of people have really made that into exactly a void to throw their energy into. I think in this country we have a lot of people who would like to, who are getting really angry, who are becoming more politically active, who don't like to see their sovereignty being taken away. So you have a lot of real, you know, freedom fighters here in America. Then suddenly this QAnon phenomenon shows up, where, and I really think it's, you can call it deep state, you can call it empire, whatever you want. I think it's just the control system that's kept people docile, that's kept people just dying in wars, you know, being mind controlled one way or the other. They're putting out a little bit of truth that they can kind of prove sometimes, and people who would be very, very politically active right now, who would be, you know, righteously angry and making political change, are just basically glued to their phones, the black mirror, say, well, what does QAnon say this week? And QAnon just says, basically, do nothing, keep reading my posts, and trust the plan. There's these secret good guys that are going to win. We're going to win, you know?
Yeah. That QAnon thing is total bullshit. It's CIA. It's like Snowden and WikiLeaks. It's CIA. It's a way of making you believe that the revolution is underway, so you don't actually have the internal revolution among yourselves as an individual. That's Snowden. Snowden was like that. Snowden stated nothing. Nothing. He said nothing. Okay, all the years he told us things we already knew. WikiLeaks, the latest. What's the difference between this latest QAnon thing and the WikiLeaks drops? The same thing, the same bullshit. This WikiLeaks drop coming in, it's going to have 10,000 files in it. Now we're going to work and decipher it. And we've looked at it, and guess what we discovered? That war is bad. This is the kind of shit that these people have trapped themselves into. And it's crap. It's crap. And this QAnon is another form of these elegant psyops created by the intelligence services to keep you believing in bullshit. And like you said, they're staring into their black mirror waiting for the latest thing, just like they were waiting for this latest Snowden thing, just like they were waiting for the latest WikiLeaks thing. And what did all that stuff come to? It didn't come to shit. Nothing. They never told us anything that we didn't already know. And QAnon is exactly the same way. And I'm actually depressed and saddened to see people I thought who would know better falling for it again. They fell for WikiLeaks. And there was web bots before that. I remember that. But I don't think that was intelligence services. That was just more bullshit. And suck you in. So the last thing you can actually depend on is yourself. It's salvation again. Or we're going to be saved by the digital robot. It's crap.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's like rather than take an active part in the revolution, you know, an active part in the peaceful revolution, basically, we're just watching the revolution on Twitter. So really, it's like, you know, rather than get off your ass, you can just watch Twitter. Yeah, man, the revolution is real. Check it out. Q says this and trust the plan. Okay, back to my, you know, TV show and frozen pizza.
Yep.
And I think a good term, I like what we just came up with. I like the idea of the Q, instead of QAnon, just the Q psyop. That's what I'm calling it from now on, the Q psyop.
That's it. It's a big psyop. Yeah, it's a big bullshit, dead-end cul-de-sac that leads people nowhere. And the after WikiLeaks and Snowden, they should have woken up to this by now. But sadly, no.
No, they don't. Well, another amazing line from your YouTube on Get Off the Chessboard was, and I know, and this is kind of a joke, I know, but I found it to be, it's just funny and it has a lot of meaning. Soy to the hipsters is what, let me start that over again. Soy to the hipsters is what communion wafers are to the devout Catholics. And, you know, can you expand on it a little bit? There's just so much meaning in there and it's funny and I love it.
Oh, well, I'll tell you how that came about. That day I'd said that. There's this place I go to near where I live here in Ireland that makes fantastic soup. They make beautiful, amazing soups. And two young people running it, and I was supporting them until I found out that they were using soy as a thickener. And I said to them, why don't you do it? Why did you use soy? Why do you use soy? You can use flour, a roux, flour and butter. And they go, oh, well, everyone's eating soy now. It's good for you. And it's soy, which is basically liquidized animal feed that causes guys to become girls and girls to develop too soon, is seen as some kind of wonderful thing by this generation, or a certain type of this generation, that it's somehow... You know, the soy industry has successfully demonized the dairy industry. It has successfully demonized a lot of things. The wheat industry. See, this I wonder about these gluten intolerance things. You know, have gluten. I was looking at some pasta the other day. Always check your labels, by the way. And it was gluten intolerant pasta, and it was made with soy. By soy that's durum wheat. And I often think these are kind of black magic spells. Bread makes everyone sick. Here's soy. Milk and dairy makes everyone sick. Here's soy. I don't trust this stuff. I know how the dark side works in terms of marketing and corporations, and I wonder about it. And they're obsessed with soy. They can't get enough into them. Not only are they not content with eating it in all their dishes, but they now have to drink it from containers like it's a soda or water. They cannot get it into them fast enough. And you read things that even, like you see written by hipsters saying, it reduces toxic masculinity, whatever that's supposed to be. And It's frightening. But yeah, it's there. And it just popped into my head. It's that day that I said it on that video. It is. It's a communion wafer to them. It really is. It's like a sacred sacrament, a food sacrament. It's like kosher or halal soy.
I like the idea of it being dark magic. If we prepare wheat the way our ancestors did with like sourdough, basically, that yeah. tends to make the gluten, it eats it up basically, and there's much less there. So something that I that gets me when it comes to the gluten intolerance is I go to the Elks Club here in Scottsdale, Arizona. On the wall, they have all the presidents of the Elk Club that I think are there for, like, your president for a year or something. So they have these, you know, portraits, these pictures of all these guys back, I don't know how many years, like 70 years, I'm not sure. But I look at people, and I know that our ancestors were eating, you know, lots of beef, and they were eating lots of wheat. And I look at these pictures, and I go, well, if gluten's bad for you, these guys were eating tons of it. And we, you know, 70 years ago, 100 years ago, we were way, way, way more healthy, obviously, than we are now. And we were eating just plenty of grain back then. So I think if there is a downside to it, I wonder if it's just the glyphosate and the like inorganic practices of growing it. And also we're not preparing it as we did historically in ways that we knew seemed to have a positive health benefit.
Well, yeah, the last one I think hit the nail on the head. Preparation of food is sacred. It's not so fast food is like black magic food. Think about it.
And I like that.
You know, you have all these, you know, those guys, their wives and their mothers and their sisters cooked for them, and the food was prepared with love and care, from simple ingredients that were usually in season, and usually local, and I totally believe that when you make food for someone you love, it's like a great one here is that we Irish, we drink more tea than anyone else on earth. We're the number one tea drinkers on the planet. And every Irish person will tell you, if you really want to know if someone loves you or hates you, get them to make you a cup of tea. You will taste it in the tea. And that's absolutely it. And I think you have like, and as you said about the sourdough, these breads that are made in these mega bakeries, they're not properly proofed. They're often filled with soy again in order to speed up the baking process. They are usually a water, the industrial process is not going to work well in you. They're not family bakeries. I mean, you go to a small family bakery, you can taste the difference instantaneously because the family care about what they're doing. Same with a small family restaurant. It's the same thing. There's an energetic force that's put into food during preparation. And it's if love for the people you're feeding is put into that food, they will be healthy. And I think that is something that it is almost like a food sorcery that's never spoken about. And maybe it's a whole subject that needs to be dealt with at some point, not by me, but someone else in the future. And have you ever seen anything about this? Like, you know, people say, oh, my aunt's cooking or my granny's cooking or my dad's cooking. Nothing ever tasted as good as it. What you were tasting was the love.
No matter how much a person might be trying to cut down on the sugar, you know, or avoid wheat, you know, when grandma makes cookies, well, you're going to eat them, you know, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I do like, it's very true. I think that food that is made in a factory, you know, mass prepared food, I call it machine food. And machine food, as you get more sensitive, you know, machine food is never as wholesome. In fact, it's hard not to feel a hit to your health when you're eating machine food. After you get used to making your own food, it's a wonderful experience. Fast food being a form of black magic, I'm just going to call it fast black magic now. That's my word for fast food now. It's fast black magic. When it comes to the mainstream media these days, and I guess this is really all media of all time, but I'm going to speak specifically of the extremely polarized mass media of today. Is it dangerous to see a TV at all, especially if you're looking at like mainstream media programming?
I guess by dangerous, the effect it has upon you. Of course, you know, it definitely does affect people. Anyone who says there's no such thing as magic or sorcery, I suggest that they look at the Super Bowl halftime commercials. These corporations spend enormous amounts of money in order to, because they know that they have basically a spellbound audience. And I call this trash magic. And this is like what Alan Moore and other people have spoke about. This magic today is in the hands of the corporations, the marketers, the advertisers, in the most crudest forms. It doesn't do anything to enhance human, you know, our shamans and our, you know, druids and whatever, and the magi in the past, they worked magic for the benefit of the tribe. Nowadays, magic is worked for the benefit of the corporation and or the state. And so people, well, they watch these things like the Super. I mean, I saw one, it was about 3 or 4 years ago. I think it was Katy Perry. And she was on stage dressed like a Bud Light can. Now, she wasn't dressed exactly like it, but she was dressed in the same color scheme and the same graphic design in the clothes she was wearing, singing her song, as the Bud Light can. So she was basically a singing Bud Light can. Now, you look at this, the sales of these corporations in the wake of these things, they go through the roof because people have been targeted in their subconscious. This has been going on for a long time now, long before TV. In the old days, Philip Morris used to tell Hollywood executives the point where the hero of the film was to take a cigarette out and light it. He was to take a cigarette out and light it at the time he either killed a bad guy or he had basically seduced or was about to seduce a beautiful woman. And there were lots of things that would show people. They would monitor. Philip Morris's executives would sit in the cinema watching the audience and seeing the men pulling out a cigarette at these pivotal points in the film. So it's been going on for a long time. There's nothing new about it. It's when you're aware of it, it's not dangerous. It becomes fun. So if the idea of people say, I'm going to throw away my – I'm not going to watch anything on TV ever again. No, that's not a good idea. There's still, you know, good TV shows on now and again and good movies and stuff like that. But you can actually turn it into a hobby. You can see when your psyche is being attacked in a movie or a TV show, and it actually can become quite a good form of entertainment for yourself to watch something and say, ah, did you see that? They're trying to sell me this soda. Did you see that? They're trying to market this kind of political thing. Like, for instance, today, we see endless virtue signaling towards political agenda. So we see, like, the latest season of The X-Files was hilarious, how endless things of anti-Trump things without saying them. You know, we're living in dark times. You know, this kind of thing, we're living in serious times, or this kind of thing. You know, and people believe that stuff. They actually – I was watching an excellent TV show called The Path. And the Path is about a cult in Brooklyn. Very good TV show it was too. And they kept talking about hate crimes – are at an all-time high. I don't know. Are they? No, it's invented. This was invented to manipulate your consciousness to serve a political agenda. And this is, and it becomes quite entertaining after a while when you see through it. So it's that's how you impose your will upon it. You look at it and you see it for the clear manipulation that it is. And what happens then is you're taking back your energy from it and you're building up your psychic defenses.
I like that. Make it a hobby. Yeah, I try to notice it but not empower it. Somehow, you know, view it without giving it emotional energy. Definitely.
Other than ridicule and having a laugh at it.
I like that. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, limit or yeah, yeah, kind of govern your reaction to it to you know, mockery and humor. I like that. That kind of that definitely pisses the demons off. That's for sure. They don't like being laughed at. A video you did recently called "How to Practice Real Magic in the 21st Century." I dug it. I think it's great, and we'll link to that, of course. And this is a bit of a broad question way to start this, but to focus on that a little bit. What do you consider, or how do you define magical practice in one's life right now?
Well, in terms of the 21st century where we are now, magic is a creative process based on garnishing from cultural means and tropes. We see this very much with like 4chan and the memetics and Keck and all that kind of thing. Energy forces that can actually improve your life. In fact, that's the purpose of magic, really. You know, I know you hear the things about like art and science in accordance with will, but ultimately, if you're what you're achieving with your will is your spiritual or your creative or your psychic self-development. Now, ritual magic is is archaic at this point. It's a thing of the past. And the reason why is, say, in Victorian times, there was a lot less energy available at the time. And even before that, I was talking to somebody today. There's a very good channel called the Occult Book Review Channel on YouTube. And the reviewer there was saying about John Dee, and how John Dee, basically his magical incantations and rituals were done through Christian prayer. And the reason for that is at the time Christianity was going through a state of turmoil. Catholics and Protestants were killing each other. You could be sentenced to death for having a non-Latin version of the Bible in England. And so there was tremendous psychic energy, and praying was a way of channeling it. Later on in Victorian times, the wealthy got into the magic ritual process, and they did basically had everything they wanted in life. They had no suffering. So they had to create complex ceremonial rituals in order to build up the psychic charge to get what they wanted. Well, we live in a world today where energy is everywhere. It's very achievable. You can get energy from a roller coaster ride, a bungee cord, going to a rock concert. I used to go to soccer matches and hold a sigil up when the team I supported scored a goal in amongst the hardcore fans, just to power that energy into the sigil. And these things are available these days to us like they never were before. So magic in the 21st century, in order to remember, you should only do magic to develop yourself spiritually or creatively, not to impose or change another person or another. That's black magic, when you impose it on someone else. And it's everywhere. And magic in the 21st century, I was trying to explain to people, you don't have to get involved in Enochian tables. You don't have to get involved in complex ceremonial rites wearing costumes. You don't have to do any of this. It works. But it worked in the same way that a Wagner opera worked 150 years ago. You can do the same thing in a 3-minute black metal song today. At least the same amount of energies. Energy is compressed and abundant these days for us to take into it. And people want to practice magic. They don't have to go get all caught up in these vast magical systems and schools anymore, because energy is attainable everywhere and it can be harvested anywhere. And then when they start to see that, they will see everything as magic. What they're doing then ultimately is hacking the operating system of the universe. I encourage people to do things like put-ups. In my case, I use collages. They're random pictures, and you'll actually eventually see the synchronistic aspects of that. You're hacking into reality. You're seeing the future before it happens. Now, you're not seeing the future like a vision, and you're not channeling, and you're not a great person. What you're doing is you're seeing that psychic footprint, or that quantum footprint, and I'm only using the term quantum because people know what that means, but it has blasted itself back in time for you to see it before others. So it gives you an advantage in life. You're less likely to be damaged by the slings and arrows of changes in society, and rather roll with them. So in the case of Trump, right, a year before, about 8 months before Trump was elected, I said he'll be the president of the United States. It will happen. And I said the reason why, this is a magical sorcery that's going on here. Whether Trump knows it or not, we're watching a magical event unfolding before our eyes. And I knew he's going to be president. And I saw the things like developing on 4chan and the Keck and the memetics, all this kind of thing, and the shit posting was all building up towards it. As soon as Hillary Clinton started attacking it, she started to actually die in real time, because she got involved in a magical war that her ass couldn't handle. And then I knew right away, immediately I knew then, that the psychic force of humanity was on the side of Trump, and the other side were actually losing. And it happened on the night of the election. If you look at that graph, you had Hillary Clinton in charge and winning all the votes. And then as approached after midnight, Donald Trump started to rise. Hillary Clinton's vote started to drop. And at exactly 3 a.m., the witching hour, it flipped. And then Trump was in the ascendancy. And that was an incredible validation in my life of magic and how it works. And people were saying, well, how did you predict all this? And I said, I didn't predict it, because of the way I practice magic, the reality in front of me is softer. And it's almost like I get synchronistic insights and intuitions that tell me what's coming down the road, not as a prophet, not as a great seer, because anyone can do this, But so this is like where you should never join cults, where somebody channels and you listen to what they're channeling, because you're robbing yourself of what you can do this stuff as well. And 99 times out of 100, they're all lying anyway. And you can do these things. You don't need to be a member of a group where somebody has claims to have great power and sees the future. You can do this. And how you do it is that you understand that you're on the forefront of reality. And creativity allows you to soften the quantum field in front of you and to give you an advantage. And when you soften the quantum field in front of you, you're still a member of this world. You're still a member of this five-sense reality, but you're a different kind. You're almost a member of a club, and you're almost like on the forefront of it, and you handle it better. You understand it better, and you things you want will come to you easier. And it's really that simple. It's the manipulation of energy, and we're surrounded by energy today, and not enough people are using it for themselves. And that's the purpose of my book, Sorcery, is to encourage people to not be afraid of these things, to understand why all history always been used, and why the elites who tell you there's no such thing as magic are all using it themselves. And it's, you know, isn't it time that you actually started doing it instead of hoping that they cast you a decent spell? And so that's what it really is, getting your will to come to fruition through honest creativity, engagement with the energetic flow of the current zeitgeist of society.
Definitely want to mention your new book, Sorcery, The Invocation of Strangeness, by you, Thomas Sheridan. And a good way for a person to develop a magical practice in their own life would be, well, that book is a good place to start. Definitely promoting that. Put that link to that, of course, in the show notes. You mentioned cut-ups in your video, right, how to practice real magic in the 21st century. You mentioned the cut-ups, and you say that those can be used, and you mentioned it now too, to see the future to some extent, to have an idea of what's going to happen. And I also wonder if those can be used as a personal ritual practice to help also create what you would like in the future. So you, like how would you do each? For the ones that are to see, is that just basically you're just going into a meditative state, just relaxing and just... How's that work?
Yeah, you're really hacking the operating system of the universe. You're actually hacking it in your favor. I've discovered cut-ups through the greatest shaman I've known in my lifetime, David Bowie. When I was about, I don't know, 11 or 12, there was a documentary on TV late one Sunday night about his cracked actor tour of America back in the 70s. And in the show, he talked about William Burroughs. You can actually find this clip on YouTube, by the way. William S. Burroughs, who did this as well. Basically, what you do, and Bowie was doing it for song lyrics, but Bowie was also heavily into the cult, particularly in the early 70s. A lot of people don't know that. And what you basically do is you write down the words that come to, just the pop, first words that pop into your head. You just sit there, relax a piece of paper, and on a piece of lined ruled paper, write down all the words that come into your head. Couple of hundred. Just sit there. The first word is plastic. The second word is rabbit. The third word is tractor. The fourth word is shit. The fifth word is help. You just write them all down, okay, with a space between them. And then you cut them all up. And so you have an individual word on an individual piece of paper, like a lotto ticket almost. Then put them into a container. I have a special box. It's a ceramic, ancient, an antique I have. Put them in there, spin them around, meditate on it in the same way you would meditate on a tarot deck before you do a reading. And then begin to take the words out and don't change them. If a word comes out or two words that comes out you don't like, don't change them. You will disrupt the process. Take out the first word and glue it onto a fresh book. The second word, glue it next to it. Glue it next to it. Glue it next to it. And at first, just like dreams, it seems like gobbledygook. But something will happen down the road. An event in your life or an event in the world. And what happens is you will see it clearly that. In that cutout that you glued to the paper. What you're doing is you're hacking reality to give you a look into the future. It's really quite frightening for people sometimes because it comes completely true very quickly. And you can also do it with collages. I used to collect pictures from magazines and comic books, and I used to cut them out, trim them around the edges, or even a phrase or a bubble from a speech bubble or a picture, and just have a big box of all these pictures, do the same process, and then do paste up like collages. And one of them was, I predicted Obama long before he was president. I think he was like the mayor of Chicago or a local Chicago politician when I found his picture and put it in the book. And lo and behold, there he is, like, and there's a picture of one that he was. There's a picture of him. You'll see it on the video if you do the link above American Revolutionary Soldiers from a comic book. Having a war and this kind of thing, and he's kind of like he's formed around the woman's nipple and this kind of thing, and it was hilarious how accurate it came. Now, it doesn't, again, magic is like gestation. It's like cooking a beautiful piece of bread, composing a beautiful symphony. It doesn't happen like that. You've got to let it gestate and build up over time as the charge increases. But yeah, I would encourage anyone to try cut-ups and look up that video of David Bowie doing the cut-ups to give you a good demonstration of how it's done. It's a remarkably effective and easy way to get into practicing magic.
I like the way you mentioned that magic makes the reality in front of you softer. I mean, that is a great feeling, you know, to kind of visualize that, to feel that, you know, magic makes the reality in front of you softer. I think everybody would like a slightly softer reality in front of them.
I'll give you a quick example of that. Someone on my Facebook page had read my latest book, Sorcery, and they were raving about it. And he had been texting me from the mountains near here. And he says, "You're not going to believe this, Thomas." He says, "Right after I texted you, I was just thinking about how these glaciers had carved out these mountains and, you know, how that all happened during the Ice Age." And he looked down on the ground, and the one piece of litter in the whole mountain was a piece of packaging that says of a product called Ice Mountain. And synchronicities are very powerful. When the synchronicities are flying, you're hacking the universe. It's as simple as that.
People should definitely look at synchronicities and omens, signs, all that, and I believe to be, you know, guided by them. And I really expect the synchronicities every day. I'm not demanding the universe. I'm not making, you know, the universe my errand boy or something. But I wake up every day really expecting a magical experience and synchronicities, and, you know, every day the universe it waves back to me and says, "Hey, check this out," and it always shows me something impossible, a synchronicity that just could never happen by chance. And I think when you start to expect it, it happens.
And it's incredible fun. You will laugh all the time at when it happens. And and that fun is part of it. You're supposed to enjoy it. You're supposed to. The universe and the cosmos wants you to play in tandem with your desires. And it's almost like a girlfriend that gives you a surprise now and again. It really does. And you're supposed to enjoy it. You're supposed to embrace it. The more you do, the more you enjoy it, the more it will happen.
I like that. That's great. Well, we're at an hour and 7 minutes, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. This has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This was a great interview.
Yeah, I can stay as long. If you want to stay a little bit longer, it's up to you. But if you're out of the questions, Greg, that's fine as well.
Oh, you know, we're actually, I could probably keep asking questions indefinitely, but I think we're at a great stopping point. This is nice and compressed and just perfect. And I would say that everybody get Thomas Sheridan's new book, Sorcery, the Invocation of Strangeness. Maybe as we wrap this up, you could give people a little intro on what's in the book.
Well, it's quite an expansive book, actually. The book is written as a ritual itself. It begins by talking about the subconscious mind, its relation to the oceans. I talk about how Lovecraft played a huge part in my development as an artist and a magician. I talk about the whole aspects of the Jungian subconscious. Then I rise people up through the moon. And so it's very much like the book itself is very much a spell of sorts. No, it deliberately is, actually. But not for me, it's for you. It's for the people reading it. It's to help. It's the your sub. It, lots of that book is really targeted at the subconscious mind of the reader, and then it takes you through the history of ritual and ceremonial magic, right from the earliest shamans, the cave artists, all the way through the symbolism of the sun, through the druids, through the magical schools. And you know, they're not, this is not complex history. I'm saying, because that's already been covered everywhere. I'm saying why this matters. You're missing out here. And towards the end, there's more sort of practical ideas, not heavy magic ritual, but things that you can incorporate into your life. And the reviews have been off the scales for the book. I'm amazed by it. People are saying it's like, I don't want to sound like it's hubris or narcissistic, but I'm absolutely delighted with the feedback. Everyone seems to be getting a lot from it. People had no interest. Even an atheist friend of mine said that he's interested in magic now, but he tries to make out it's to do with quantum science, so it's okay, the usual thing. And so it's like, do it. I mean, definitely get involved. The book will ease you into the world of magic, but it doesn't impose a system on the reader. It gives handy tips and handy ideas and things that they might want to use. But ultimately, when you close the book at the end, you're off on your own journey. It's you then begin your path. And that's really what it's about. It's not a school. It's not an initiation. It's a primer to set you off on your way, to make it easier for you and ultimately enjoyable.
You mentioned that there's more energy now available than there used to be. So what a good time to check this book out. And why is there more energy now than there used to be?
Complexity of society. We didn't have things like roller coasters and bungee cords and, you know, gigantic sports events 100 years ago. We didn't have blockbuster movies, the internet. These are all forms of energy. They're all there. They're all built from the same primordial fire. That's where they come from, when the first people rubbed two sticks together and made friction and created a spark. That energy has grown exponentially to the point now where we are saturated in energy and we can do a lot with a little. And instead of we don't have to sacrifice animals anymore, bring ourselves to pain thresholds, walk on coal fires, whip ourselves or hang ourselves from iron hooks anymore in order to reach these shamanic states. We can do it in the mosh pit at a metal concert, like I said, in a soccer stadium, on a roller coaster. And remember that when those people are, you're on a roller coaster and you have a magical intention and you're about to go down and everyone is screaming, that's the time you actually put your focus directly into what you want to achieve. And because you're using that energy right around you, because it's everywhere. In the past, they'd have to take enormous amounts of drumming and ceremonial rituals to build it up. We can get it for free these days, so why not use it?
Oh, I like that. Using bungee jumping as a ritual. Well, there you go. I mean, that's a wonderful idea. I like that. Okay, well, that's probably where we'll end it right there. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I'm delighted to be on, Craig. That was very enjoyable. Thank you.
You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A radiant creator isn't making a living, they are living.